An explosive situation is brewing in New Haven over the impending Black Panther murder trial, and the Times call for an immediate lowering of the heat and cooling off of passions. This was the opening line to an editorial that appeared in the New Haven Register on April 23, 1970. New Haven was preparing for a May Day demonstration supporting the Black Panthers and decrying the official authorities of the city. Fears grew that the violence, which had erupted in other cities, would come to New Haven. At the time, Henry Sam Chauncey was an assistant to the president of Yale University. He was assigned the task of dealing with radicalism both on and off campus. He's co-authored a book that documents the days leading up to the May Day protest in words and lots of images, posters, and news clippings, and the protest itself, which turned out to be peaceful for the most part. It's called May Day at Yale 1970, Recollections, the Trial of Bobby Seale and the Black Panthers. Mr. Chauncey, good morning. Thanks for taking time.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
You had 6 weeks, I believe, to come up with a security strategy for the campus. What was the first thing you did after getting that task?
The first thing we did was to see what other universities had done who had already had radical upheavals of some kind. And we learned immediately that no one had been successful by just throwing lots of policemen at the students. The second thing we did was to consult people at other universities, and I mentioned particularly a man named Archibald Cox, who had the same job at Harvard that I had at Yale, and Harvard had not been successful. And so we talked to him, and he said...
And this was the same Archibald Cox...
Who later became Solicitor General of the United States. He said, you have to find a way to embrace the radicals. If you throw police at them, it won't work.
You know, I can recall a feeling of tension in the surrounding suburbs at the time. I lived locally. At least in my house, there was a feeling of tension at the time with all the news about radicals coming to town. You say in the book that the majority of those radicals who would be involved in the protest weren't dangerous and had legitimate agendas for social change. It almost seems like a contradiction in terms, non-dangerous radicals. Was this an unusual perspective then?
Well, I think you have to think a little bit about what the word radical means. I take that word to mean someone who holds an opinion that isn't particularly popular today. They're not necessarily dangerous opinions. There were very dangerous radicals. The worst of the lot were called the Weathermen. People who study this period know that they did kill people, bomb buildings, and so on. But there were many, many young people and older people. Martin Luther King was, in my opinion, a radical because he held an opinion about the voting rights for minorities, which was not popular at the time. He was a very successful radical, and he was a moderate radical because he didn't believe in violence. So it's how you look at radicalism, and that's one of the things I learned from my experience during May Day was you don't judge people just because their ideas are different than yours as being bad.
So there was a danger to the Yale campus from the left. But you say in the book, too, there was a threat of danger from the right as well as the left. Who from the right?
It started with the president of the United States. We learned later through Freedom of Information inquiries that we made that President Nixon wanted very much to have an explosion on what he referred to as an elite campus. And the reason for that was that he thought such an explosion would move people who were in the center of the political spectrum to the right. He and his aides, we subsequently learned, had talked about that. Thus, the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, had been ordered to sort of keep an eye on things, and we know that Mr. Hoover ordered our phones to be tapped, and they were looking for opportunities, I think, to almost encourage an explosion. So we had the prospect of the weathermen on the left, possibly, and people from the right wing on the right, which made it quite scary.
When you say explosion, you mean a literal explosion or an explosion of people protesting?
I think the politicians in Washington wanted something that was of sufficient news value to cover the country. And that would mean probably something more than just a protest, but the possibility of people being killed, the possibility of buildings being burned down, the possibility of a president of a great university being fired, something that would capture the imagination of the broad country. So I think the word explosion is meant in its sort of maximum terms.
You mentioned phones, the tapping of phones. You made an interesting point about communication as the days led up to the May Day protest, keeping in touch with people. No cell phones, no internet. So you installed or had installed many, many old-fashioned landline telephones.
Yes, we did. And I had 40, I think. I've forgotten the exact number, in our little headquarters building where we were located. And we had a trustee of Yale by the name of Cyrus Vance, who later, of course, became Secretary of State of the United States. Cy Vance had been President Johnson's agent to bring under control the riots in Detroit in the late 1960s. And he had sort of written the playbook on how to manage this sort of situation. I asked him to come to town a few times to help me in my planning. And he came into my little headquarters and saw the 40 phones. And he said, "That's wonderful, Sam. You can communicate now. Why don't you have one of the people call you?" So I arranged that someone from a distant location. And the phone rang. And, of course, we stood there and we couldn't tell which of the 40 phones was ringing. So his eyes twinkled and he said, "I think you want to have lights on the phones."
You also mention in the book that in attempting to keep the peace on the Yale campus, you said that the ends justified the means. I think you used that phrase. Did you mean that some of the things you did or thought you would have to do were unethical?
Yes. We wanted to accomplish three things. We did not want death and destruction. We hoped very much to keep the ongoing academic activity of the university going on. And we also were very eager to separate the moderate radicals from the hard-nosed radicals. In doing that, we did things such as arranging for the hijacking of the weathermen's bus, the weathermen who were coming from Boston. Now, I don't know whether it's illegal to hijack a bus or not. I expect it probably is, and it may even be unethical. But our feeling was that preventing people from being killed, and parenthetically, one wants to remember that 6 days later, four young students were shot at Kent State by the National Guard. But people had died in these events, and our goal was to not have that happen. So I think we did things that today someone might question as whether they were ethical. I guess I'm prepared to live with that.
And we should point out the hijacking of the weathermen buses was not a violent hijacking. It was more of a mechanical hijacking.
It was a mechanical hijacking. That's right.
In his introduction for the book, Henry Louis Gates Jr., he notes that when May Day finally arrived, tanks were ready in the streets, and the Yale flagpole was greased to stop protesters from climbing and doing something at the top of the pole. Seems like there are two extremes of possible strategies to keep the peace. Of all the strategies that you did rely on to defuse potential violence, which do you believe was the most effective in helping to keep the peace that day?
Two. One was a very practical moment. One was a more general. The practical moment was our ability to meet with the radical leaders. President Brewster and I met at 3 a.m. on May 1st, that is in the early, early morning before the rally, with Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman and Tom Hayden and the others. We'd happily been able to make contact with them. And we came to an understanding that we would do everything in our power with the New Haven police to limit police presence and any kind of aggressive activity on the part of the police or the troops. They agreed that they would preach nonviolence, though they would, of course, engage in their usual four-letter word rhetoric. But we came to an understanding. So that was the first thing. And the second was that we had a wonderful police chief in New Haven, James Ahern, who knew enough to keep all the National Guard invisible from the green. And to keep if you look at the pictures in the book, you will not see a police uniform anywhere. And so it almost translates into things we see today, where we see unruly crowds and so on faced with nothing but shields and guns and nightsticks. And our belief was that if you didn't show the physical presence of soldiers and police, you had a much better chance of keeping the crowd under control.
Now, the focal point of of the protests, although, as you point out, radicals with all sorts of agendas came to town for that day. The focal point was the trial of Bobby Seale, Black Panther leader Bobby Seale, and others in connection with a murder of one of the Panthers in the city of New Haven. How did you arrange, or how did you get together with African-American leaders over that part of the protest to defuse possible violence based on that particular protest?
Well, we had some contacts in the national black community, but perhaps the greatest asset we had were the first major group of black students who had been admitted to Yale. This is a period that coincides with when Yale University and many universities decided to admit larger numbers of minority students. We happened to have admitted a very large number in, I think, 67, 68. Professor Gates, who wrote the introduction, was one of them. And this was a wonderful, wonderful group of students, very mature and leaders. And they took to the streets. They talked to the black community in New Haven. They made introductions for us where we might not have been able to make them ourselves. And so we were blessed in our ability to coalesce with the black community in New Haven. New Haven had had terrible riots in 67, and they didn't want any more of this. The black community had been devastated by those riots, and they didn't want any more. So we became allies, if you will, in the attempt to control violence.
President Brewster had made the decision to, with advice from others, made the decision to open the campus and to allow the protesters onto Yale grounds.
That's right. We decided, taking Archibald Cox's advice, to embrace these people. Yale happens to have 12 what are called residential colleges, which are really dormitories that are all in courtyard around a courtyard. And so we opened all the gates to those courtyards, and all the people from out of town were invited to come and to stay in the courtyards, use the restroom facilities of the buildings. And we fed them a marvelous diet of rice, granola, and lettuce at three meals a day, which, of course, they were very happy with because it meant they didn't have to buy their meals. It turned out to be a warm weekend, so they were able to sleep in sleeping bags in the courtyards. And I think they felt so welcome that did indeed take some of the anger out of their attitudes. So by the time they got to the green for the rally on the 1st of May, it was really almost a little bit of a party, I have to say. There was while the speeches were the usual rhetoric, people were having a wonderful time. It was a wonderful spring day.
In retrospect, it turned out to be a very good idea, but it must have been an awful risk at the time to lives and property, not to mention to the political position of the people saying, let's open the gates, let them in.
It was a terrible risk, and I can say that there were many Yale alumni who thought we were crazy, and many people thought we were crazy. It's easy to now say, well, we did the right thing. At the time when you realize how close that one bullet out of one gun could have exploded those 25, 30,000 people, it was a great risk. We did have the backup. We had the troops, the 5,000 National Guardsmen. We had a battalion of Marines stationed up in Rhode Island with helicopters, every policeman in the state of Connecticut we could get on loan. So we had a backup, but we didn't want to use that backup, and we were willing to take the risk on the hope that people of all ilks would understand that peacefulness is a better way to accomplish things.
For me, in looking at the book, seeing the pictures and the images in that book, and there are many, many pictures and
over
images
100.
In the book, it evokes, for me, it evokes feelings of nostalgia, but uneasiness too. Mm-hmm. The rally shots brought to mind for me a warning from the powers that were in my high school. They issued a warning at the time saying, you cut class to attend this rally, you are immediately suspended, no discussion, end of conversation. At the same time, those photos of the soldiers on the New Haven streets ready just in case. Those really still carry quite a punch.
Well, they do. And I have to say, looking back from a personal point of view, that I was so busy for the six-week periods. I suppose I slept 2 hours a night for the whole time. And I was so busy that I never actually felt fear or anxiety. But it was the people who weren't sort of fully occupied who felt fear and anxiety. In the back of the book, there's a wonderful poem by a man who is a plumber in East Haven, Connecticut, who was at the time, I think, 10. And he writes this wonderful poem about how his family decided that they would have to leave East Haven and go up to Hartford to stay with relatives or something. And his plaintive questions about why they were leaving and what was a rally and what was a protest. So this was happening in the entire city. I met a woman the other day who told me her husband had died and she had 2 young children, and she packed them up and went to Hartford and got a hotel room for 2 nights. So people were scared.
Having gone through the May Day experience yourself, what do you think when you see all the current clashes between the police and minority communities around the country today?
I think two things, and they are embodied in 2 quotations from Kingman Brewster, the Yale president. The first is a phrase that he used all the time, not just around May Day, but in all his work. We must never let disagreement fester into disrespect. And that is a kind of motto that I've kept in my own life, to believe that becoming angry with someone you disagree with will get you nowhere. The other is a phrase that came from a speech Brewster gave, and it is engraved on a wall around his gravesite in the Grove Street Cemetery in New Haven. And I won't be able to quote it exactly, but it is, "The presumption of innocence is not just a legal term, but the commonplace belief in the goodness of the stranger." And that was a phrase which he used in 2 ways, one in his interpersonal relations, and second, with ideas. A strange idea should not be judged ahead of time. And I will vividly remember a day in his office when a very, very angry radical came in, long hair, yelling 4-letter words, saying he insisted on seeing Brewster. And much to his surprise, I said, "Well, come right in, and President Brewster will see you now." And they went in, and I closed the door. And literally an hour later, the young man came out, and he looked at me and he said, "Boy, is that guy amazing. Do you know, he just listened to me." And so I think when I see the anger, I know the passion with which people become angry. And I see that anger, but I believe that learning to get along with each other is something that's going to help. And we must also all remember that when we hear an idea that we think is radical today, it may well be tomorrow's gospel. And if you look at in the book, you will see all these protests about everything from gay rights to women's rights to the environment, whatnot. In those days, those ideas were thought to be radical and dangerous. They are today our gospels.
Is that something you'd like readers to take away from your book?
Yes. I mean, I can't think of anything I'd rather have a reader take away than to think about the fact that when you hear an idea that you don't agree with, you might pause and ask yourself whether there's a chance that that someday might be something that you would actually agree with.
So there are older readers, my age, maybe a bit younger, and certainly older, who will remember this event, folks who lived around here. Younger readers, perhaps it's just a blip on a timeline. Can both groups take that same feeling away from this book, do you think?
Yes. I happen to still be associated with Yale University, and I have student advisees, and I actually met with a group of them 2 nights ago to do a little talk about the book. And one of the things that is fascinating today is that young people are just as passionate about change and challenging authority, but they are not willing, the way they were in the 60s, to act out on that passion. And I spend some time tweaking them a bit as to why they're unwilling. And it's a combination of 2 things. One, I understand That is, they're worried about a black mark on their record, an arrest or something like that, and what it'll do in getting a job. The one I don't understand, I often hear from them, is I don't know enough to go out on the streets in protest. And I cautiously remind them that never in our society have young people been able to know more than they know today, given the internet and the access to knowledge and information.
Mr. Chauncey, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much. It was great fun to be here.
Henry Sam Chauncey is the co-author of the book May Day at Yale 1970, Recollections, The Trial of Bobby Seale and the Black Panthers.